Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, reminding you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's not just a bank, it's a credit union. It belongs to you and money comes back in the end. Information at www.mecu.com or steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. So we're going to take a look at a little national and foreign policy and how they may be interrelated in this world today and what's been going on. We've seen the news in the Middle East where a leader of Islamic State was killed by American SEAL forces going into Syria. And there's debate over who this person was and how deeply important he was. But that did happen. And we're seeing that Ramadi, which is a major city in Iraq, getting closer and closer to Baghdad, is... Some people say on the verge of being toppled by ISIS already. Others saying it's on the, that it has been toppled. Fierce fighting is going on in that city at the moment. Refugees fleeing and other troops going in. America said they may lend support to that. That's happening. We've seen those pieces of news and what's been happening in Yemen as well, around the Straits of Hormuz, which is where much of our oil flows and a lot of oil flows and always has been a point of control for many Arab and European empires throughout history. And we saw the president's announcement that we were going to open Chukchik Sea to oil drilling, and that's caused a huge consternation for some and cheers from others. These things in some ways could be connected. Maybe they're not connected at all. But they all involve oil. They all involve our need for oil throughout the world, and controlling it and exploring it in new ways. So we'll see those connections and also talk about what's happening in the Middle East at the same time. We are joined here by Jim Phillips. James Phillips is Senior Research Fellow for Middle Eastern Affairs at the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign and National Security Policy, the Davis Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Jim, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you.
Stephen Miles joins us, Advocacy Director for Win Without War. Stephen, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
And Dr. Fahim Yunus is with us, senior fellow at the Hofburger Center for Ethics at the University of Baltimore. He's also a clinical professor of medicine at the University of Maryland. Fahim, good to have you back in the studio
again. Thank you very much, Mark.
And you all can join us at 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Comment on our Facebook page. Send us an email at talk@steinershow.org. But do join us, 410-319-8888, and any way you want to get in touch. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this. So let me just start the broad sense, then come down to the specifics of what's happening, especially in the Middle East, with all of this. And I don't know, Jim Phillips, I mean, I think all things are interconnected in life. It's hard to – we parse them out in our way of doing news and things, but they aren't connected. And do you think I'm making – too much of the statement, the thought that perhaps there is a connection between the opening of the Arctic and the battles around Ramadi?
No, I think that there are definite connections in the sense that the reason the U.S. has been focused really since the withdrawal of the British east of Suez back in 1967-68 on the Persian Gulf is the fact that that region is a strategic storehouse of more than 50% of global oil reserves. And the reason the Carter Doctrine was promulgated after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan was the U.S. feared that Soviet Union was going to move in and dismantle Iran and take control over a lot of those oil resources. And the reason we pushed Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait in 1991 was that he had absorbed Kuwaiti oil resources, and we were nervous that he was going to keep going and overthrow the Saudis and form a Iraqi empire there that would be hostile to the West. And I think the reason we went in 2003 was that we feared that Saddam was translating those oil resources into weapons of mass destruction. It turned out they weren't there, but he was still legally liable to prove to UN inspectors that he had destroyed them, and he never did. And I think the reason we're still focused on Iraq In addition to the, you know, the broader fight against Islamist terrorism and Islamist revolutionary forces in the form of Islamic State or Al-Qaeda or the Iranian version, the Shia version of that Islamic State, I think the reason we remain focused is that although our dependence on Persian Gulf oil has been reduced, the dependence of many of our allies, especially in Western Europe, Japan, South Korea, still remains very high.
So, and so, Stephen Miles, let me turn to you about these connections, and we kind of parse some things out here. I mean, and I think there's also these connections to what you're seeing in this country, the discourse over whether it's the pipeline from Canada to Louisiana, or whether it's opening up the eastern seaboard to oil drilling, or whether it's the Chukchi Sea and opening for shale oil and more. I mean, these things all have this kind of they're intertwined.
Sure, and you know, I actually have to agree with Jim. I think our natural resource fixation and our focus on oil is a huge part of our involvement in the Middle East, but. To the connectedness point you bring up, you know, our efforts to do things like drill for more oil in the Arctic or the Keystone XL pipeline, we're really putting a Band-Aid on an arm that's been cut off, essentially. I mean, climate change and the crises that climate change is spawning, you know, directly related to the violence and conflict you see in Syria, directly related to the violence and conflict you see in Yemen, yet we devote a minuscule, paltry sum of resources to dealing with that threat. And instead, we are arming ourselves to fight the wars of the future that will be spawned by climate change, rather than doing any sort of investing today in trying to prevent those wars from ever happening by addressing climate change. So I couldn't agree more. They're all these issues are connected.
Fahim?
There's very little disagreement among the panel today, Mark. I fully agree with what they're saying. The problem is, let's take it a step forward now. In nature, they say, there are neither rewards nor punishments. There are consequences. So once we agree, if our foreign policy, our Middle East policy, has been based upon our fixation with oil and energy, then we have to understand that all of what we are seeing today is not fundamentally an Islamic problem. This is a consequence of the game, if you were, to say that we have played, because in those 60 years, we have created a demon out of Saudi Arabia, the Sunni wing and the Shia wing from Iran. So there are consequences that we are facing today. We can label them all on some radical ideology, but essentially what is happening, and I think Jim started exactly at the right point from the 1950s, from Mossadegh, when the Britain were there in Iran, 51% of the oil was going to them, and then the nationalization of oil industry. Now, from there, you fast forward today, and what are the consequences? What is the price we have paid in climate change, in the price in the aspects of our own national security, and the values that we have compromised in the process, liberty and justice for all? So it's a huge price, and the consequences are enormous.
So it's interesting, I think, that in some ways how all four people here, host included, kind of agreed on some suppositions about the connectivity. You can agree about connectivity, but disagree on, and I'm trying to get you all to fight, but one can disagree on what that means and what that means for foreign policy. What that means for our policy around oil and gas drilling here in America and across the world. So, I mean, I think that is and who determines that policy would be another question maybe we can wrestle with. But I think that, I mean, I think, Stephen, let me go here and then we'll go over to Jim. I mean, what does that say to us about what we should be doing then? I mean, we've seen what's happening with the war in Iraq that's kind of dismembered Iraq in many ways, and it's coming apart at the seams, and now another city's falling to Islamic State. The American forces going in a small number to take out the ISIS leader, whose name I'm forgetting at the moment, but who was born in Tunisia. It'll come to me in a second. But so I apologize for that. But so what does that say about where we should be going?
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right, Mark. I think this is the point at which we'll start to diverge on your panel. you know, I think if climate change and some of these conflicts are that's the fire that started, we have to ask ourselves what we're doing in the region. And right now, it's pretty clear that we're just pouring more gasoline on that fire. You know, Barack Obama is now the fourth president in a row to bomb Iraq. I am hard pressed to imagine that anyone can make a compelling case that Iraq is a safer, stronger, more stable, secure, better partner for the U.S. right now than it has been. I mean, this is a failed policy. Our drone strikes in Yemen have fueled a climate of chaos that has helped it make that conflict worse. These conflicts have real and difficult solutions that are going to be hard to come by. They're not going to be easy. They're not going to be the kind of thing that's satisfying on a nightly newscast or on 24-hour news. But the types of political solutions, the types of long-term, lasting, stable pieces that need to be made, that's what we're not pursuing. Instead, we're looking for that quick and easy fix. We're looking for that decisive military victory. And unfortunately, these conflicts don't have that solution.
Jim?
I would agree that the administration's strategy in combating ISIS is in big trouble, in part because although we have air power and if we have the intelligence, we can use drones intelligently. But the problem is we don't have reliable allies on the ground to combat ISIS, especially in Syria. In Iraq, there's the Iraqi government, which has been tremendously weakened. And I would argue in part because the Obama administration withdrew abruptly back in 2011 and took our intelligence counterterrorism assets with us, and that created a much more permissive environment for the Islamic State or ISIS or ISIL, whatever you want to call it. But on the other hand, that just wasn't an American state. Mistake. The Iraqi government under the Prime Minister Maliki really blew a chance to bury the Islamic State, or back then Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And unfortunately, it chose to pursue a sectarian Shia agenda, and that raised the hackles of many Iraqi Sunnis, and eventually they came to see ISIS as an evil, but a lesser evil than a Iranian-dominated Shia Islamist state in Baghdad. And that helped ISIS revive and ascend to power, allied with many of the remnants of Saddam Hussein's regime. Many of the military leaders in ISIS are former Ba'athists, former intelligence and military leaders, and we're seeing, the groups with very different ideologies cooperating against the Shia government in Baghdad, and eventually, if ISIS is going to be defeated in Iraq, the Baghdad government needs to reach out to Sunni Arabs in western Iraq and Anbar province. And Ramadi, the city that fell, is the capital of this Sunni-dominated Anbar province. And ISIS cannot be defeated militarily, in part because it's an ideological movement, and in order to undermine that ideology, you need to reach out to the people that are open to that ideology, and that means Iraqi Sunnis. And that's something we've done very badly at, and the Iraqi government has done horrible at.
The question I would have that pushes this a tad further, Fahim, you can come in before we go to break here. I'm going to go to Kiwa, and who's our first caller up, so hold on while I get your call. I think that I was thinking about what President Barack Obama said on December 17th, when he, with Raul Castro of Cuba, began to open the doors between Cuba and the United States after 50 years. And one of the things he said in that thing was that after 50 years of a failed policy, we have to try something different. So is it time for us to think of to try something different? And what does that different mean? Can you try something different?
Agreed. Completely agree. I think we need to somehow be ahead of the curve. We do all the right things, just too little too late. We're usually 10 years behind the eight ball. If you really look at the statistics since World War II, it took us 5 to 10 years to agree that the war was a mistake, whether it was the Vietnam War or the Iraq War. Mark, you and I could not have this conversation in this studio in 2004 because Abu Bakr Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, was probably killed now. He was the most trusted American man in the prison back then. You know, this is the problem we're having.
What do you mean he was the most trusted American man?
He was in the prison, and, you know, he was the man, according to the U.S. commanders, that who could be trusted, that who was working with the prisoners, who could keep them in control, and ultimately was released because he was not considered a threat. Abu Bakr bin Baghdadi, he was in our custody.
Oh, the head of ISIS.
The head of ISIS,
I'm sorry,
yes.
Yes, yes,
he was released.
Right.
So this is the reality.
Right, right,
so all I'm saying is that we are about 10 years late in recognizing the truth. Not that we don't recognize it at that moment. We do. But it's just the evening news, like it was the point was made earlier. There are certain things there is no room for that kind of conversation. So you asked me, how do we get ahead of this thing? I think the real question is we need to make a clear diagnosis that the policy of oil, the policy of money and dollars cannot be put in front of human lives.
So we have to take a break here. We come back. I'm going to go right to the phones, and then I'm going to Kiwa, who's our first caller up, and see what that person wants to tell us. But I'd like to then come back and think about. The power of the interest of oil in Washington, D.C. in America, and the power of the use of oil and all of its subsidiary products on the planet Earth is huge. I mean, there's not a nation on the planet that's not affected by its use of the oil-based economy. So then in the face of that power and that reality, and we have a foreign policy we have to figure out, we're stuck in the middle of a quagmire that we helped create in the Middle East, then what do we do next? Where does this take us? What is the debate we should be having at this moment is what I want to ask the three of you. After we get back from our caller, Kiwa, we'll be taking a short break and coming right back. You're listening to Sunshine of My Life by Stevie Wonder. We could use all of that right now. It hit number one on this day in 1973. We'll be right back. And if I thought our love was today, I'd find myself drowning in Well, if we get to her voice, that will be Grace Jones, and that's my Jamaican guy. She was born this day in 1952, and Grace Jones is one of those performers who broke the mold and created new forms of music and ways of presenting herself and created new genres of music. So we celebrate her birthday today, 1952. And we are here today with Jim Phillips from the Heritage Foundation, Fahim Yunus from the Hofburger Center, and Stephen Mills from Win Without War, as we look at our foreign policy here today. And you at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. Let's go right to the phones. As I said, Kiwa, you're on the air. Is it Kuwa or Kiwa? I'm sorry.
The name is Kaya.
Kaya, welcome.
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good morning.
Good morning, right. It's morning here in Baltimore, yeah. Right. Yeah.
I would like to make a few points. One of your hosts mentioned about the invasion of Afghanistan. Categorically, is incorrect. The Soviet Union did not invade Afghanistan. The Soviet Union assisted Afghanistan against the onslaught of imperialism aggression. In regard to Iran, he mentioned about the West was scared about the Soviet Union overtaking the oil fields in Afghanistan. That is totally incorrect. The Soviet Union have never invaded any country to take the resources similar to imperialism. See, history has shown that imperialism, colonialism, and neocolonialism is the idea of class divided society. It seems to me your guest is not addressing the real issue facing the masses of people in this region and around the world. It's not about ideology. What ideology are you talking about in regard to ISIS? it's an imperialist ideology that ISIS have. ISIS, Al Qaeda was hatched by imperialism. They must have the audacity to point out that. ISIS, Al Qaeda, you name them, they are enforcers of imperialism. And it's no accident that imperialism, they need resources. And you mentioned Malcolm, they take it by bloodshed. No love lost, no compromise, they just take it by bloodshed.
Akilah, thank you so much for your thoughts. And let's pick up where you left off. And I think he was talking about what you said, Jim, earlier. And I wanted to go to you anyway to kind of jump off here and everybody just jump right in and Stephen come in too as well as soon as Jim finishes. Picking up this idea, we can debate the question of what gave birth to IS. Many people say it is our war in many ways allowed this embryonic explosion of fundamentalism to gain power. Some people disagree with that, but I think that goes to the heart of also where we go from here.
Okay, I could take it back to, we were talking about oil and the importance of oil in the world economy, and I think one of the reasons we've seen an explosion of Islamic movements on both Sunni and Shia sides of the coin is the huge transfer of oil wealth to oil producers after the 1973 Arab oil embargo quadrupled oil prices. And there's been hundreds of billions of dollars transferred to, the Persian Gulf oil exporting states. The Iranian Islamist regime controls a big chunk of that, and it's turned that into supporting ideological revolutionary movements such as Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Shia militias in Iraq, and lately the Houthi rebels in Yemen. Shia, a very muscular Shia brand of Islamist radicalism is supported by oil. And then also on the other side, the Sunni side, Al-Qaeda was fueled by charities and charitable donations at first of many rich private citizens in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the Gulf. And in fact, ISIS in Syria has sustained itself with oil. My broader point is that Al-Qaeda on the Sunni side and Iran on the Shia side are promulgating a radical ideology. And as conservatives say, ideas have consequences. And the consequences of those ideas for non-Muslims are not very good. You can get you can get crucified in Syria today. You have your head cut off. You could turn into a sex slave if you're Yazidi. These are very bad consequences. But even for the Muslims that live under these systems, they're horrible. And I would compare it to, the Nazis coming to power in Germany and promising a utopia for Germans. They promised heaven and delivered hell.
Right.
The Soviets, the same thing in Russia, promised heaven, delivered hell. And now we have Al-Qaeda and ISIS promising heaven and delivering hell to the Muslims that are forced to live under them.
So I want you to go. I did want to go to Stephen. But you want to say something for him about the Islamic portion of this, and let me go right to Stephen Miles with his thoughts about where we go.
Yeah, I disagree with this whole notion that somehow the non-Muslims are paying the price for this. I think you asked me the solution. Why is it so hard to understand the simple fact that we should do unto others what we would want others do unto us? Why is that such a utopian idea now in America, that fairness and truthfulness are good values? Why is that, people call me naive. Well, then stop teaching it to my child in elementary school, because there's a huge disconnect. What I mean by that is, since 1991, 2 to 4 million Muslims have died in these wars. That's a genocidal number if you think about it. 2 to 4 million. Just because there are 1.6 billion Muslim does not mean that you go to percentage and minimize that number. So there is a huge problem, and I don't completely, but partly agree with the caller's comment about imperialism. You know, nobody invited in Middle East, there is a saying, they say it's far better for you to raise potatoes than to have oil. Because if you're a potato farmer, you're not likely to get bombed. I'll leave it at that.
Stephen Miles.
It's hard to follow that. But yeah, I mean, I have to take some disagreement with that, too. I mean, I think in some ways talking about the problems we're seeing now is kind of like talking about a fever and ignoring the underlying illness that's causing it. You know, we have a combination of a host of factors, from repressive regimes that have not allowed any type of political expression peacefully of their citizens, to, again, conflicts being fueled over natural resources, not just oil and the attempts to control oil fields, which is part of this, but also look at a country like Yemen. You know, Yemen is maybe the first country on the planet to run out of water. There are cities in Yemen that, within a very short order of time, will not have any drinkable water. If you think that you're going to put a bunch of young people in that situation with no jobs, with no potential for future, with no way to subsist on a day-to-day basis, and then throw on top of it ready access to weapons, flood the region with military means, and then, oh, for good measure, throw in a couple of drones that fly above every day and occasionally unleash hellfire missiles from high above, you know, and bring death and destruction. Guess what? You're going to have a conflict. It doesn't really need you to have it be fueled by Saudi or Iranian money feeding Islamic extremism at that point. You're going to have a conflict at that point. So I think we need to take a step back and not just look at the symptoms, but also some of the underlying causes of this. And there's no way to do that without taking a giant step back from the immediate crises that we're in, recognizing that we're going to have to deal with those. You know, you don't not treat the fever, but you also have to look at those underlying symptoms, or we're never going to solve these problems.
But I guess the question I really want to push a bit more here, I mean, is, and I'm trying to make this connection one more time and come back to some larger foreign policy questions for the three of you, is that, for argument's sake, I mean, we're seeing the United States now becoming, for the first time in a long time, a oil exporter and a gas exporter. And energy, actually, in terms of oil and gas, self-sufficient in many ways, relying less and less on foreign oil. So our policies around the world are, and if with this Arctic drilling, if it actually does work, which many people doubt, or this other drilling taking place does work, it'll mean that there'll be more oil from the American market and gas in the American market flooding the international market, which has to do with battling the oil prices around the world as well and dampening those down. So what does all that say about where we are? I mean, about what is going to happen to our foreign policy, how these things are connected? I think they're connected on many levels. They're connected on the power of people who run multinational corporations and the oil money. They're connected in terms of the oil we produce here because of that and how that affects foreign policy and affects our foreign policy in the Middle East that we are now mired in. Because when you said that, two to four million, is that what you said?
That's right, two to four million.
And it's not just 1.4 billion. You're talking about 2 to 4 million Muslims who are killed who are in the Arab world, which is even a smaller, a larger percentage.
Smaller number, yeah, it's a smaller number. But, you know, to very quickly add something, Mark, oil, let's peel that layer, and there's a deeper layer to that. It's a simple number. It's money. Actually, it's not even about oil. It's about money, which means power. Here are the money numbers. Kurdistan, no matter how much oil we have in America, no matter how much independent we become in our energy, Kurdistan will remain one of the cheapest places to drill for oil on earth, because today it costs us $5 to $10 per barrel in Kurdistan, $50 to $80 per barrel in the U.S. Those are the numbers. And the oil companies know those numbers. $1 trillion have been invested in Kurdistan over the past 10 years. And there is a reason why you wonder, we have our drones looking after these farmers in the northern areas of Pakistan, where the hit rate for every target, we have admitted this, that for every high-profile target, we kill 50 civilians. Why the hell can we not bomb these Humvees and these Toyota trucks that are out there? You know, somebody has to wonder. ISIS is not hiding somewhere in a farm. They're out there on the roads like a brigade, like a platoon. You don't have to put boots on ground for that. Ultimately, it's money. There's money involved. There are guarantees of that oil to flow from Kurdistan to Turkey. And ISIS is, believe it or not, a part of that.
So agree or disagree with what Fahim said. I want to know what that means about what the debate should be. We should be having in America we're not having, or maybe are having and not hearing, around these particular issues and policies. Stephen, and then we'll go to Jim. Stephen.
I mean, I think the debate should not be about how we get more oil, because it's only looking at one part of the equation, right? You're only looking at how can we, if your goal is to how to get the U.S. to disengage from the Middle East, maybe sure if you got the U.S. completely weaned off of Middle Eastern oil, but for the reasons that were just said, I don't think that's going to happen. The oil is just too cheap. It's just too readily important to the global economy, and it is a global economy and a global market, so the U.S. is just one part of that. But the bigger issue is, even if you did that, you'd still have these conflicts there. You know, we ignored a war in Syria for several years, or for a couple of years before we started to take any attention to it. You know, even if we weren't paying attention to the Middle East because of our foreign policy, those of us on the progressive side would have some deep concerns about what was happening there from a human rights perspective, the massive loss of life, the massive violation of human rights, the massive pain and suffering of many, many people. That won't be fueled by simply getting the U.S. less dependent on foreign oil. That's only going to be fueled in the long term by decreasing the causes of these conflicts, including climate change, including repressive regimes, and ultimately decreasing the U.S. military footprint in the region that is prolonging these conflicts, not making them go away anytime soon.
Jim? I mean, picking up from what he said, from what Stephen said.
I'm having trouble hearing the callers and the other speakers on the phone, but I hear the one in your studio, but I'm not sure I caught everything there. But I would just say that I think in previous eras, we've looked at oil as a scarce strategic commodity, and we've had to safeguard the free flow of oil from the Persian Gulf, primarily against states, first the Soviet Union and Iran. But increasingly in the future, I think the threat will be an ideological threat coming from organizations such as ISIS or, al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda's franchise in Syria. To me, the debate we need to have is realizing that what we call the war against terrorism really was an ideological war, not because terrorism was a tactic used by revolutionaries to advance their Islamist radical agendas. And we made a mistake in just looking at bin Laden as, a one-off. We tended to personalize him without seeing the broader ideological threat. And since he's died, his ideology has flourished, not only because of the dysfunctional governments in the Middle East that, would shut out one or another minority, but also the Arab Spring, which raised hopes of so many people. And I think people in the West were exhilarated by that and thought that democracy was automatically going to follow, didn't really appreciate that, unlike Eastern Europe, where democracy was the default alternative to communism, in the Middle East, Islamism is a much stronger alternative to dictatorship and to democracy.
But let's take this again one step further, since we're in this area. Let's stay here for a minute. I mean, I think that we need to kind of continue the discussion debate about the role that the West had in helping unleash the forces we're talking about today, from the Afghan War through the Iraq War and more. But regardless of that, and also thinking about that at the same time, that it's here. And when you look at Boko Haram in Nigeria, and thank God many of the girls have been rescued from that, and they're hearing now that there are stories of torture and rape that happened to them after they were freed. But you look at Boko Haram, you look at Islamic State, you look at al-Qaeda, you look at any of these groups, you look at Saudi Arabia as well, as a state run by people whose ideology is not that dissimilar, given how they practice Islam. That's not the majority of Muslims in the world.
Absolutely.
If that's not the way the majority of Muslims in the world think,
yep.
Then what, and that we have created, we have gotten ourselves in the middle of these wars in the Middle East, in Iraq, now in Syria, in Afghanistan, in the Near East, then we really, I think, are not having the debate in America about what our next steps should be. people say withdraw. Well, you can withdraw. That doesn't end it.
Yeah.
What is our policy? What are the debates we should be having around what our policy steps should be now instead of doing the same things we've always done over and over again?
Yeah, they say the right answer is usually the hardest answer of all the options, and that's why people don't pick it, not because they don't know what's the right answer. Mark, we are a country deeply obsessed with justice. I'll give an example. 2 years ago, in our football season, they did not have the regular referees, and these alternate referees made some bad calls on the field. You remember that. There was an uproar. They had to bend over backwards, bring the real referees in, because the country is obsessed with every yard, every inch. This is American DNA. That is why I keep saying the discussion should be, will I do the same thing to my own people? 65% of Americans approve drone strikes. 65%. But when you ask them if the terrorist is hiding in America, that number drops to 15%. What does that tell you? That tells you the chasm of fairness that we have in our society today. We don't see that difference. Why should it be any different? We should always look at justice and fairness for all. We should always, at every policy step, will I have someone do this to my children? Will this be okay in America? If it's not okay in America, then it's not okay in Iraq.
But what is that? Who is that? Stephen?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I mean, I think there's a couple of things. I think you know, it's an old adage, but it's true. When you're in a hole, stop digging. So that's not to say that you retreat and you withdraw and you get over it, but we do have to recognize the things we're doing right now are making the situation worse, and we need to stop doing some of those things. You know, dropping bombs from the sky is not bringing peace and stability to these regions. But we also need to take a step back and say that, you know, I'm sitting here in Washington. A lot of the people making these decisions are sitting here in Washington as well. And frankly, no matter how many experts we have here in Washington on this region, quote-unquote experts, we don't fundamentally understand these conflicts in a way that is going to allow us from thousands and thousands of miles away to solve them. When you look at what happened in Ramadi, you know, there was 1,000, give or take, Iraqi soldiers. There was 250, 300, maybe 400 ISIS fighters. This is not a conflict in which we're looking at, you know, tens of thousands of troops overwhelming a couple dozen guys or something like that. You know, there are severe forces at play here that are not simply about military might, and it's about a broader conflict and dissatisfaction with the government in Baghdad and lots of other things. But the people in Iraq are going to have to be the ones to solve that conflict, just like the people in Syria, the people in Yemen. They're going to be the ones who have to live with the peace, and we need to do a better job, and this is really hard for us in America. We need to do a better job of listening to those voices and listening to the solutions they're proposing and supporting the ones that make sense and helping build bridges to peace instead of just adding more fuel to the fires of war.
So, when you just talk about building bridges of peace instead of widening and deepening the war, and what you said at the top about it and if you see what you're doing, we have to stop digging this hole that we keep digging deeper and deeper. But I still don't know, and I've had this kind of query with lots of people on this program over the years. What is it now? It was very clear when we started before the war in Iraq. The debate was very clear. You either go to the war in Iraq or you don't go to war in Iraq. And that debate was clear on two sides. No, yes, we should be invading Iraq. We should not be invading Iraq.
But Mark, that's a logical fallacy.
But now we're at a place where we have invaded. We did have a war in Iraq. Libya is now dismembered. Iraq is dismembered. Islamic State is real. What should be America's response? Did they go, okay, we're just going to have peace talks? We're going to step back and do nothing? Or we get involved how? You know what I'm saying? That's the debate that we need to be having.
But before that, there has to be acceptance. I haven't heard that acknowledgement. I have not heard the acceptance. I don't think the Middle East has heard anyone say, yes, we actually did kill 2 million people. Instead of using the passive voice, mistakes were made. That's extremely insulting. You know, you have to really be in their shoes to understand that when the most they hear from a U.S. president is mistakes were made, that is extremely insulting. We don't have, we need to first correct the wrong. We have to get their hearts and minds. We don't have their hearts and minds. And what we have created, I'll read a very short thing to you. This is a letter to editor that gone viral, and it tells you the state of Middle East today, where we are. And I think halfway through you're going to lose it. But this is a fun
thing. Don't make it too long. We don't have much time.
No, it's 1 minute. 1 minute. Sir, Iran is backing Assad. Gulf states are against Assad. Assad is against Muslim Brotherhood. Muslim Brotherhood and Obama are against General Sisi. But Gulf states are pro-Sisi, which means they are against Muslim Brotherhood. Iran is pro-Hamas, but Hamas is backing Muslim Brotherhood. Obama is backing Muslim Brotherhood, yet Hamas is against the U.S. Gulf states are pro-U.S., but Turkey is with Gulf states against Assad. Yet Turkey is pro-Muslim Brotherhood against General Sisi. And General Sisi is being backed by the Gulf states. Welcome to the Middle East and have a nice day.
I saw that letter. The New York Times, I think that letter was in, right? I remember that letter. So, 410-319-8888 before we end this conversation. If you want to join the conversation, please do. But Stephen Miles, I'm sorry I have to be laughing through that one, but I mean that I remember reading that letter in the New York Times, and I cracked up, and I read it out loud because it's real.
It's real.
And that's what I'm saying. We don't have a coherent idea what the hell we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look at what's going on right now. You know, the problem is we try to draw these conflicts into very clear lines, good guys, bad guys, on our side, against our side. You know, you've got Shia militias allied with Iran, Iranian Quds force on the ground fighting on the same side as us in Iraq, ostensibly, versus in Yemen, where, you know, we're refueling Saudi fighter jets that are doing bombing runs against Shia-aligned Houthi rebels who are receiving some support from the Iranians. So, you know, even when we try to draw this into clear lines, it becomes confusing and obvious that we're on both sides. I mean, I think there is one side that very clearly is winning all this. And when you see American-made refueling jets, refueling American-made Saudi fighters, dropping American-made bombs on American-made weapons that we gave to the Yemeni government that are now in Houthi controls, you can understand why the stock prices of Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and General Dynamics are through the roof. You know, business is good for folks in the business of war. And, you know, that should not be lost in this conversation, that there are people making a lot of money on all this killing. They're making a killing on the killing, if you will. We really need to ask ourselves what role all of this is playing in that, and if some of the voices we're hearing in this debate, when you turn on CNN, when you turn on all the other news channels, then these are guys who are being paid by those companies, if we're getting the type of public debate we should be getting out of this, or if we're getting things that are good for the bottom of the lines of the arms makers.
We only have a couple of minutes left here, Stephen. Jim, but I want to come back to you here. I hope you heard some of what Stephen was saying.
Oh, yeah. No, I think one of the reasons for the confusion, is going back to the letter to the New York Times, is that we generally ascribe to states goals that are related to national interests, and we assume that if the government reflects the interests of the people, then it would be a pretty predictable what the national interests are. But the problem is that increasingly in the Middle East, states are being captured by radical ideologues that see themselves as the vanguard of global revolutions, whether it's a Shia Iranian version or a Sunni Al Qaeda version. And yeah, there is a problem with imperialism, in part because these people want to build empires, Islamic empires of a Sunni or Shia variety, and they're willing to sacrifice thousands, millions of people, millions of Muslims, to realize that utopia, kind of back to the future. They're going to go back to the 7th century to recreate an imaginary utopia that they think they can bring into our times. But in the process, I think their followers are some of the biggest losers.
Closing thought. We have like a minute left.
No, I think this was a great panel. Once we have the recognition of the wrong done in the past 20 years, and once we have the will to put justice ahead of national interest, then things will be right.
Well, this has really been interesting. And clearly, I mean, I think that the ongoing debate in this country and here on this program, I'm going to try to focus in, at least on our program that I can control to some extent, the idea about where we need to go and what our policy should be, because clearly where we've gone now has, I think, wreaked a lot of havoc on the Middle East. And even though some dictators have been overthrown, what's been left in their wake has been anarchy. And as one friend, acquaintance from Baghdad said, he said he would rather have to face Saddam's thugs than he would the anarchy of the streets, not knowing he'll live for the next day. There are a lot of contradictions here. And so things that we all have to kind of wrestle with since it's being done in our name in this country. Jim Phillips from the Heritage Foundation. Jim, great to have you on the show again. Thank you so much
for
being part of this. And Stephen Miles, great to have you here from Win Without War. I will look forward to having you back.
Happy to do it.
And Dr. Fahim Yunus, always good to have you in the studio.
Thank you so much for being part of this program as well.
We're about to go to break. Time for our news break. We'll come back and we'll look at water shutoffs here and in Detroit and what they mean. And on our way to break, Waiting in Vain by the great Bob Marley and the Wailers from their album Legend. This album was released to commemorate the third anniversary of Bob Marley's passing and hit number one in 1984. We'll be right back.